Spencer, last week we talked about Strava's new podcast, Athletes Unfiltered, and its second episode called Rising from the Ashes, the amazing story of Austin Reba and his Trail Co. project. This week, let's talk about another one of the stories in the Rising from the Ashes episode, and that is about Steve Johnson, a disabled veteran who has battled through so much adversity and medical setbacks, yet he continues to ride his bike. What are your takeaways from this story?
I've got one really big takeaway, Fred, and that is, if I ever feel like I'm having a bad day, I just think about Steve's story because, man, this guy has persevered through so much. He had just all these medical issues. He had rheumatoid arthritis, cancer. He had just a severe broken leg from a mountain bike crash. I mean, this guy's been through it all, and he still is. He's still riding. He's still keeping it together and trying to do what he does best.
Yeah, I'm with you. Whenever I am going to be feeling low, I don't want to ride my bike, I'm just going to think of Steve because just a really motivational story. And again, that is episode 2, Rising from the Ashes, of Strava's Athletes Unfiltered podcast. Give it a listen, and thanks to Strava for sponsoring this week's episode of the podcast. Let's get on with the show. We're back with the Velo News podcast. I'm Fred Dreyer in the bowels of the Velo News world headquarters here in Boulder, Colorado. It's a sunny day outside, about to snow. We're going to have to get the fat bikes out again. Joined this week by Spencer Paulison.
Hey, Fred.
Hey, Spencer. How are you, buddy?
Fine. Yeah, it's good. Creepy when you talk to me like that, but whatever.
And in the chair to my right is Chris Case, managing editor. Chris, You rode your bicycle this past weekend, right?
Always, yes.
Yeah, was it 100 miles, 200 miles?
No, just 80. It was actually a struggle for me to get out and do 80. Yeah. I've been running a lot more these
running?
Days.
Running?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, how dare
Isn't
you?
Isn't that crazy?
We have a great episode this week. In the first part of the episode, we're going to break down all the action from the Cyclocross World Championships in Bogenza.
Bilbo Bogenza.
We saw some awesome, just exciting edge of your seat action. Crashes, not surprising winners, but dramatic racing. And the second half of the show, we have a real treat. We have an interview with the Tour de France champion himself, Ooh. Geraint Thomas. Spencer caught up with Geraint Thomas in Southern California a few weeks ago to talk about his book, his memories from this past year's Tour de France, all sorts of different things, and we are going to check in with Geraint. Spencer, how set the scene. What was it like interviewing Geraint Thomas?
Well, as you might expect, the winner of the sport's biggest race, he started to live, I think, a little bit of a life of luxury. I met with him at the Soho House in Malibu, California, which is a super exclusive members only club. I had to rent a Bugatti so that I wouldn't stand out in the parking lot. Walked in, met him upstairs, nice little view looking over the Pacific Ocean, people out walking with their dogs and kids on the beach. And afterwards, I dug into a delicious brunch spread that they laid out that I don't think I was technically nice. Allowed to eat, but Geraint told me.
The perks of journalism.
Geraint told me, he said, quote unquote, smash the brunch. And I said, yes, sir.
To get into the Soho House, did you have to put on like a monocle or some leather boots or just something like fancy guy suit?
I went with the tech bro disguise.
Okay.
I just, some distressed jeans, a little t-shirt, and, the old Apple earbuds. And I just pretended like I was really distracted.
Yeah. You're like, I invented Blurbicon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look it up. Don't Google it, Bing it.
We just went public.
Well, we can't wait to get to Geraint Thomas and his interview. Guys, before we break down the cyclocross action, we do have to reference a not-so-happy story that happened this past week. We wrote about it on the site, and that is the affair with Ilio Caiza in Argentina. If you want a full catch-up on what happened, read it on the site. Long story short, Ilio Caiza of Dacuna Quickstep snapped a photo with a fan, made a lewd gesture with the fan. He was kicked out of the race. Dacuna Quickstep's management kind of backed him up. There was a big brouhaha. Again, we don't have to dig into all the gory details, but just let's offer some takeaways from this before we get into the cross action. Spencer, what's your take?
My take, just having watched this all unfold and seeing Dacuna Quickstep kind of eat the trash for a while before finally apologizing on Friday. My take is just that cycling is really similar to a lot of mainstream sports out there that have these scandals, that have these moments of bad behavior on the part of the athletes. And I think that sometimes, at least personally, because I am a cyclist and I participate, I feel like maybe our sports, I feel like it's maybe a little immune to that sort of thing sometimes. I'm a little close to it. But now when you see this sort of thing happen, you realize, yes, this is still a pro sport. There are still athletes that probably feel a little entitled and sometimes act badly. And I think we should just all be vigilant for this sort of thing, and we should continue to hold them to a higher standard, because they should be held to a higher standard. They are role models in our sport. They're very visible. They're powerful. And it's not okay for someone like Ilie Oukaisa to basically harass this 18-year-old cafe employee.
Coming in hot with a take. Chris, do you have a take to offer up to the good people today?
Yeah, I think it, to reiterate what Spencer has said, it was just the quintessential poor steps taken. The things they did just made things worse. It just showed this chauvinistic attitude, really, and that's sad and something that. Like Spencer said, we got to be vigilant to get stuff like this out of the sport, to get this strange attitude of entitlement or chauvinism out of the sport.
I'm with you guys. I mean, I don't think anyone supports this type of behavior. My whole thing is, you know, cycling is making a very public global push to appeal to women. It is trying to grow the women's side of the sport. It is, USA Cycling is trying to open up, you know, cycling and participatory cycling to more women. It's a male-dominated sport. We need more women in the sport. And when you see something like this happen, it doesn't fully torpedo those efforts, but it really is, it stands in the face of what the sport is trying to do from a 50,000-foot level. So, there needs to be repercussions. And, yeah, if, you know, pro cyclists need to hold themselves to higher regard, our sport is really trying to advance its image and bring in more people, whether it's women, men, minorities, whatever, and the athletes need to be respectful of that. Okay, moving on. Let's get to all the action from Cyclocross Worlds. On Sunday in the men's elite race, we saw Dutch phenomenon Matthew van der Poel take, I believe this is his second elite world championship title.
Yes.
It was not particularly close. He was really good. Chris, you watched this race.
He's always really good.
What's your breakdown of the race? Take me through it.
So the course lends itself to sort of group racing a lot in the early stages of many of the races. So it was fast, but there weren't those places where it was separating the group out in the probably first two, three laps of the race. And you could see Matthew being patient like he has been in the past, and you could see some of the expected players come to the front. But it really came down to that crux moment when there was this off-camber section. Matthew was riding it incredibly smooth. He made it look incredibly easy. You could see everybody else, honestly, in every other race, struggling on that section. And Matthew was giving it a little gas, and Wout Van Aert was on his wheel, and he tried to ride it that first time when the mistake happened, and his back wheel slid out, the gap opened up. Matthew took advantage of that. You can see this was a great example of what confidence can do for an athlete, or how it can shatter somebody's confidence in a mistake like that. Every other lap after that, Wout would not ride that section. He it was in his head that he was going to mess it up again, or he couldn't do it. It wasn't that mistake was the race in a sense, but Van der Poel, you could see him from his technical skills, from his physical skills, from a mental standpoint, he was far superior. And that was like every other race except for two this entire season. He DNF'd one race early, and he came in 21st at Copenberg Cross because he was on a tremendously off day. Every other race, 27, he won. this year.
Yeah, Vanderpool, I mean, capping off just a complete dominant year. I watched this race too, and I was completely blown away by that, by his ability to ride that off-camber section. Wasn't a long section. I mean, it was, what, like 25 feet? Not far at all. But in the women's race, that's where a ton of slip-out slides and crashes happen. And then in the men's race, it was so evident that all the men were having to dismount and ride it. And Vanderpool didn't just ride it. He made it look like the sidewalk. Yeah. He made it look like he was riding on flat ground. And for all we can say about how strong he is, how dominant he is, just his ability to look smooth on some of the trickier sections of this course really, really stood out to me.
And the interesting thing, too, for me was hearing on the broadcast that he was on the same tire setup as Wout van Aert. And so perhaps there's a little difference in the pressure selection, but regardless, there shouldn't have been a significant advantage or disadvantage when it comes to the actual equipment thereon. And the one other thing I'd add, going back to what you were saying about this being a more of a group race, Chris, is I personally was a little disappointed by this course. There was a very extended section of pavement going into the finish, or the start-finish, yeah. I should say. Yep. And that really lent itself to the groups sort of regrouping, yep. After a selection was made, maybe early in the race. It certainly happened in the women's race. I think it happened a little in the men's race, too. I just wish they'd found a way to incorporate a few more technical elements to this course, because as it was, it just came down to that single off-camber section. And yeah, the races were fairly exciting, but I feel like this falls short of being a real proper world championship level course in my mind.
I think wind played a part in helping people play a little cat and mouse, not want to drive into the wind on that straightaway. So that helped hurt the racing a little bit and helped things come back together again and again. It's interesting. A lot of people were saying, a lot of the winners, of course the winners were going to say they liked the course more than people that lost on the course, but I was surprised that they were saying such good things about the course, because from a fan perspective, I thought it did lend itself to less exciting racing than it could have been.
So last year we had the much anticipated battle between Wout and Vanderpool, and Wout won decisively. What are the big differences, the big takeaways this year compared to last year? What are the big differences that we saw?
I mean, the conditions were just completely different. This was a fast race. I would imagine they were probably running intermediate tread tires. It wasn't very muddy at all. It was a little slippery, I think, probably due to the humidity coming off the ocean there, that sort of thing. But I mean, looking back to last year's race, which was just absolute mud fest, I mean, there's night and day difference. And I think generally the kind of common wisdom is that Wout van Aert's a little better when it's a heavy day of mud racing. And that's kind of how it was at the World Championships in Valkenburg last year. But this year, I think Vanderpool was able to really use his top-end power, which I think still is better than Van Aert.
I mean, it's also just a different year. Wout wasn't... Vanderpool dominated most of the races last year, too, but at the end of the season, you could see that Wout was coming back to him a little bit and beat him in some races later in the year. Nobody has beaten Vanderpool this entire year. I mean, it was his race to lose, as they say. He's just on another level.
Another moment of dramatics happened towards the end of the race when Toon Aerts had actually ridden his way into second place and was looking to have a really impressive finish on his end. I mean, he ended up third. That's still impressive. But anyway, he slips out in a corner, allowing Wout van Aert to ride back into second. What were your feelings and your analysis of that moment?
I didn't really have a strong preference one versus the other. I think they're both fine riders, and I'm not like an avid Toon Aerts fan, nor am I like, you know, gonna live and die by Wout van Aert's results. But I was excited to have some action in that final lap. As you'd said, Vanderpool pretty much flown the coop. You knew he was going to win. So to see Toon Aerts kind of hoving into view was exciting. It gave us a little bit of an unexpected finale there in the final lap. And then to see him slide out on that corner and crash like that definitely a disappointment, but surprising. And I think it gave us some of the drama we were hoping for in that final lap. It's just unfortunate for Tunares that it came down to a mistake like that. But I will say that there's probably some things that contributed to that mistake. In part, he burnt a lot of matches early in that race. I think he was quite strong overall. He may be stronger than Van Aert, just purely in terms of his efforts. But, you know, those add up and those affect your technical skills when it comes down to the end of a race that's over an hour for the winner, an hour nine for Vanderpool, which is extremely long for a cross race. And to have the two-time reigning world champion breathing down your neck, that's gonna change the way you ride if you've got a couple second gap on him and you're trying to get your best ever world championship results. It's regardless of whether he's a fellow Belgian or not.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Chris? Do you think Tunaerts is going to be nipping at the top step here in another year or two?
I do. I think you may have said it somewhere. Vanderpool focusing on mountain bike in the run-up to Tokyo. Van Aert sort of moving over to road maybe a bit more. Tunaerts might be the next king of cyclocross if he doesn't do either of those things and focuses solely on cyclocross. So regardless of that, he's had a breakthrough year. He's won World Cups. He was very close to beating Wout in the overall in the World Cup.
He did.
I'm sorry. So he held off Wout.
Big effort in that final World Cup race.
That's right.
In Hoogerheide, and it was that
so
was amazing.
I mean, he's right there. And in fact, I would say that win tally or results wise, he was better than Wout this year.
Oh, definitely. I would totally agree with that. Yeah.
The Tune, man named Tune.
Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes. Going to be winning cross races in the future. Well, that was the Elite Men's Race. There are highlights online. I recommend everyone check it out if you haven't watched it. Super fun race, but not as fun. Not nearly as fun as the Elite Women's Race. Saturday, I woke up early. I was sitting on my couch. The dog was staring at me, asking me through his dagger-like eyes to go walk him. I said, no, dog, we have to watch the Elite Women's Race. And we did, and he was very upset and whined a lot. Elite Women's Race, Sana Kant wins her third consecutive world title. I called it last week.
You did.
I chose Sana
Kant. Fair play.
And Matthew Vanderpoel.
I called Vanderpoel, too. I called it first.
Who didn't?
Sana Kant wins. Chris, give me the breakdown of this women's race.
Well, again, you saw a lot of group racing, and in fact, the group racing lasted almost to the very end of the race in this case. There were several Dutch ladies, Betsema, Annemarie Wurst, Lucinda Brand, Marianne Vos. You had Sana Kant. You had this inability for any one rider or inaction on any one rider's part or team's part, for that matter, to take control of the race. And so they come into that long paved straightaway. Maybe there was a headwind, but it just kept coming back together and coming back together. You saw some mistakes out of some key riders, including and particularly Lucinda Brand. Before she had her incident in the pit where her father grabbed the bike, and maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more, she was making some mistakes here and there, and all of those things add up because you got to come back from that, and you got to burn some matches to come back from that. So eventually, Sana Kant took the bull by the horn, so to speak, and set off on her own, and that was honestly what she needed to do, and it was very successful, and she rode very smoothly. She was technically probably the best in the race, and she had the power to hold off everybody in the end. Even though Lucinda was coming back, she had that power. She just didn't have the technical skills to match it. So,
one against many, an individual versus a team. Sana Kant versus all of the Netherlands, it seemed like.
Yeah, we had Dutch women going second through fifth place behind Sana Kant.
Brutal.
And then Sophie Dubois was ninth, just for good measure. They're good at cyclocross.
On the broadcast, they were referencing that time Ian Stannard outrode the like four or five quick step guys that he was up against. And it was like, how does a team do that. Go ahead, Frank.
Well, similar to that moment, I think we can be critical of the Dutch team's riding. Look, second through fifth place, chapeau to them. That's great finish. As a team, they showed their dominance, but they had the opportunity to win, and it really felt like there were a few moments, irregardless of the crashes, where just their decisions on the field of play did not catered to a Dutch victory. I'm thinking early on when Annemarie Verst and Denise Betsema were pushing the pace at the front of the group, yet Lucinda Brand and Marianne Vos were trying to chase back on. And that was a moment where I was like, what are you doing, you know? And then there were a couple moments where I really expected them to employ road tactics and to go, you know, one by one, start attacking Sana Kant. And, you know, maybe the course itself just wasn't conducive to that type of riding. But for whatever reason, I didn't see that dynamic play out.
Yeah, I agree with you, Fred. There's definitely some questions I have about the tactics of it. Now, you know, the disclaimer is that cyclocross, it's very difficult to execute team tactics in a cyclocross race. But when it comes to armchair quarterbacking, Monday morning or Tuesday morning, whatever day it is, yeah, I would have liked to see, at the very least, I would have liked to see the Dutch team put a rider on the front of that lead group and control it a little more, because they were putting Sana Kant on the front of that group, and that really gives her about every advantage she could ask for, being a lone rider against a team of at least four others in the front group. Because, you know, if Kant makes a mistake, it's okay. She probably can hop on the wheel of the next rider if she gets past. If she feels great and accelerates, that'll put the other riders under pressure. If one of the riders behind her makes a mistake, that'll mess up the other Dutch woman, and who knows what the order is back there. Like you said earlier, Brand was a little far back in the group, made some mistakes, and was in trouble at certain points. So, yeah, I say you got Marianne Vos there. She can easily take the front of this group and control it. Put her in that role and have her do that, because, you know, you've got plenty of cards to play.
So Lucinda Brand finishes second place. She was obviously on great form. She won the World Cup in Hoogerheide the week before. Really just a breakthrough season this year. I mean, she's been a good cyclocross rider for a while, but I believe she won two World Cups this year.
Three World Cups.
So, you know, she had some problems in this race. She slipped out noticeably a few times on the off-camber section, but then the real coup de grace happened in this pit exchange with her father. Chris, take me through the pit exchange scene around the world.
Yeah, well, cyclocross is a chaotic event. Pits, even more so. Late in the race, you're cross-eyed. What you see on the footage is she comes into the pits. Someone, it turns out to be her dad, but her catcher, so to speak, takes the bike from her. She's holding onto the bars. She's not unclipped. She gets pulled into the ground and crashes, and then quickly gets up, gets back on her second bike, and out she goes. But she loses some time. To me, so it turns out that it's her dad. She says that she blames her dad, but she's gonna forgive him so that they can have Christmas dinner together in the future.
Very important. Christmas dinner.
Personally, I don't necessarily believe it was entirely his fault. I think it was maybe both of their faults to some degree. I think maybe he did grab it. She said that he grabbed it a little early. I think that if that's the case, she also held on a little too much or didn't unclip the way she should have and been prepared for him to take the bike. Again, you're cross-eyed. It's just an unfortunate thing that happened, but it can happen.
And this is definitely armchair. This is armchair pitting right here.
Yes, oh, yeah, for yep. sure.
Well, let's get into it then. Like,
yeah.
I would agree with you, Chris, and say for Lucinda, her homework is to anticipate a little more.
Yeah.
Unclip a little sooner and be ready for it. And for her dad, he should probably think about softer catch.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, when you're rolling into a pit and dismounting like that, the bike's still moving, it's still rolling, it's still going to balance at least for a little bit. Worst case scenario, it tips a little and he can catch it. he doesn't have to grab it super hard and super quick, and certainly not in this instance because there was no rider behind her. Sometimes it gets a little crazy if there's two riders coming in at the same time. The pit crew has to be
pull the bike out of the way.
You got to get out of the way as fast as possible. We even have, I think the Hoogerheide World Cup, we saw a collision in the pit where two riders came in and the pit crew didn't grab the bike well enough and they crashed. So yes, there are instances where you have to be very aggressive with the grab, but in this case, I mean, she could have just ghost ridden it basically, and it would have been fine.
Yep.
It's a big, big moment. You're on the biggest stage of the whole cross calendar. Everyone's nerves are on edge. You can understand how it happened, but it's really unfortunate.
Yep.
We recommend going to your local library, checking out Mark Legg's series of videos on how to pit, episodes 1 through 96. I think it's a 96 part thing. No, joking.
I heard that Katie Compton had the same thing happen to her in the race.
Well,
I don't know that for sure, but Helen Wyman on the broadcast said that may have happened to her.
Maybe
too,
it was just a bad day for pitting. You know, sometimes that happens.
Bad medicine.
Well, it was a phenomenal race. Congrats to all of the participants. Before we get out of here with crosstalk, you guys watched the U23 men's race.
I did.
Just give me a little taste of Tom Pidcock and his impressive riding. Well, Chris watched it.
Yeah, no, I thought it was awesome. I mean, just watching him, he's so relaxed. He's so calm. He sat back. He let that group racing do the group racing thing. He was patient. 2-3 laps in, he took a second bike. He's at the back of a train of a lot of riders. His main rival, Ellie Iserbit, notices that he's back there and attacks hard. And Pidcock worked his way past a couple people. They get to that long straightaway, and it was unreal how he closed the gap to Ellie Iserbit and then blew past him till Iserbit's face just melted off of his body. And it was the moment. He just completely crushed him mentally and physically and rode away from the race from there on. It was awesome.
Congrats to Tom Pidcock. Just attacking
baby
cross course.
Baby Vanderpool.
Yeah, well, he's dual threat as well. He races for Team Wiggins on the road. He was even sixth in a stage of the Tour of Britain last year. So he's no joke. And maybe he's going to end up just doing road, because certainly seems like he's got the talent. He's got the engine for it.
Yep.
Well, cross season done and dusted. Before we've put the final bow on it, let's check in with our good pal, Professor Cyclocross. He's tweeting some stats today. Ooh, World Championships Coenza confirmed the season's trend. Flemish TV ratings, lowest in 10 years. For the first time for the men's race, and for the women's race, highest in 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So now the women's audience, 82% of the men's audience.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's not good that the men's race is down, but it's good that
the women's
racing is getting more exposure. People are more excited to watch it. Yeah. That's good stuff.
Okay. Well, it's time. It's almost time to get to Mr. Garrett Thomas. I know you've been listening through this crosstalk to hear what Garrett has to say. Spence, before we get to Garrett Thomas, just a little bit of rapping about his book. So he has his new book, The World According to G, out now. It was out in European markets a few months ago. It is now out in American markets.
The Tour According to G.
The Tour actually. According to G.
The Tour According to G.
You and I both took a spin through this book. What are your takeaways?
My takeaways are that Garrett Thomas is, it's pretty hard to rattle him. He's very even keeled. He's very cool. He's got perspective. He gets frustrated by some things throughout the course of this 2018 tour that he won. We've heard about those in the headlines, such as Team Sky telling him that they wouldn't wait for him in the team time trial, and Team Sky withholding an air conditioner from him when it was really hot in the Alps. And of course, also this incident toward the end of the tour when Chris Froome said he wanted to attack on one of the pivotal mountain stages. Garrett Thomas, he saw all this happen. He got a little annoyed with it, but he let it slide, and he moved on. He focused on what he had to do. He focused on the race. But he's not afraid to air these grievances, though. That's the thing about this book, is there are a lot of pro cycling books that I think the writers will gloss over some of the juicy details. He just puts it all out in the open, and he lets it speak for itself. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I talked to him about that actually in this interview, and he says, hey, you know, this is how I like to do things. This is how I like to do interviews. I don't really want to dance around stuff or have a PR script that is handed to me. I just want to be straight up about it. He's just a nice bloke you have a pint with down at the pub.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think a very telling section is early on in the book where he is addressing his media persona and how in past situations he had been asked by the PR to say a kind of a canned statement, and he's just like, I can't do that. I'm really bad at that. I can't do that. And so he's just like, I have to be me. I'm with you. I thought he was very revealing with some of his interior thoughts. I covered that tour. I was at a lot of these stages. I was talking to him at finish lines in the scrum. I was, seeing him at the beginning. I was in this big press conference that he references on the second rest day where he's sitting by the world's smallest swimming pool. I was like, yeah, it was the world's smallest swimming pool. I was there too.
Hot tub?
No, it was like a mini pool, huh. Like a teeny pool.
Weird.
But Garrett, to see his interior, to read his interior thoughts, I thought was very interesting because, yeah, there was a lot of comments being put out there by Brailsford, by Chris Froome, by the team saying, hey, everything is simpatico. We're all on the same page here. But for him to then write, actually, we hadn't really talked about stuff.
Yeah, they really didn't communicate as much as you would imagine they would.
While I was at the tour, I was envisioning, okay, they're having these meetings in the hotel room every night, and they are communicating things like how to be, how are we going to manage, these different types of situations, and how are Chris and Garrett going to be on the same page, and to have him say, well, actually, we weren't really doing any of that. Every now and again, a few days there were meetings and they would talk about it, but it was not as organized as one might think. And then to me, the really telling moment is I believe it's stage 17. This was the super short stage.
Yeah.
And
Col
de Portet. And it's the night before the stage, and the whole Team Sky, they're having one of these meetings. And Geraint Thomas is in yellow, and he has a pretty good lead. And Chris Froome says, okay, guys, I'm going to attack at the base of the final climb. And Geraint Thomas is thinking to himself, that makes no sense if our goal is to keep my jersey. I am in the lead of the Tour de France. This is one of the last hurdles. Why are you going to attack? But he just thinks it. He doesn't really stand up for himself. And team management is all on board with Chris Froome. And there's this interesting moment where Geraint Thomas has to process it. And he has to basically go from what the F is going on to, okay, you do that. We'll see what happens. I'm going to be a good soldier. And he takes you through his interior thoughts. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and just imagine if those roles were reversed, right? If Chris Froome was in yellow going into that day and Geraint Thomas was close, but not that close. And he stands up in the team meeting and says, okay, guys, here's my plan. I'm going to attack. Chris Froome will be like, oh, I don't think that's such a good idea, lad.
I don't think that's wise.
Really throw the cat amongst the pigeons if you were to do that.
Well, again, the book is called The Tour According to G with Geraint Thomas.
The Tour According to G.
Didn't I say The Tour According to G?
No.
The World According to G? It's The Tour According to G with Geraint Thomas. Let's get to hear Mr. Geraint Thomas.
All right, so we're here with Geraint Thomas, G, which is easier for me to say. Yeah. We're here in Malibu, California.
Thanks.
The beach. The beach is looking beautiful. The rain's gone away. So you seem to come here to train fairly often now, to come to Southern California. When did that start? Talk to me about your relationship with this area, your history with this area.
Well, it kind of started, I wanted to do something different. So I'd done tour down under 6 or 7 years in a row, and it was really good. They worked well for me, but I just wanted a bit of a change. And traditionally the team, if you don't do down under, you're in Mallorca, and kind of done that every year at least once for the last sort of 17 years. So I was like, I can't be going there again like 2-3 times a year. So wanted to change. Spoke to a few guys and heard that it was quite good out here. My wife has a cousin here, so we got a few family members, and Cameron Worth, the Ironman triathlete, trains a bit here. So yeah, last year I thought, why not give it a go, and it worked really well, obviously. And I wanted to come back again, and it's nice. It's 8 hours time difference from the UK. You're kind of just away from everything, and it's great training for me. Other than the rain for this week, but it still wasn't cold, and yeah, the climbs, you kind of get everything you need for January. So, and then obviously there's stuff you can do on the time trial bike up and down PCH. So, yeah, for this month to really get that big workload, and it's ideal.
Yeah, good to catch some Lakers games too. I saw that.
And yeah, it was just
me, Fat Joe.
Yeah, that was so weird because when I was in school and things, like, you know, I was really into hip hop, and yeah, just to bump into Fat Joe in the corridor was just mad. So I thought, oh, I gotta get a picture. But
I take it you didn't know who you were.
No idea. But yeah, I've just been really lucky. That's one of the biggest changes, really, since obviously winning the tour. Like, get to go courtside at the Lakers game, and went to the Rams game as well at the playoff one before.
Right.
So it was just really cool, and you know, it's just, I love America as well. It's just so different to the UK. It's everyone's just a lot happier, it seems, especially in California. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
And yeah, it's just a nice place to hang out. And you know, once you've done your training, I was doing 5-6 hours on the bike, and my wife's family were here for the first 2 weeks. So she wasn't just sort of sat around waiting for me to come home type of thing. It was, so everyone has had a really good time.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting for us Americans. Your book will be coming out here soon. I've gotten a chance to read it. I really enjoyed it, actually. It's
thanks.
You know, a lot of cyclists in their books, they tend to kind of gloss over tension, or they're a little withholding of some of the details that we're all really curious about. But you really dug into it, especially, you know, this tension that you felt maybe with Team Sky's management, the situation with Chris Froome and the Tour de France. Why did you choose to go there with your book? You could have left it out, right?
Yeah, but like you say, you know, I think a lot of books are just seem to be a bit wishy-washy and not honest and stuff. And that's what the one thing I always try to do whenever doing interviews, and just wanted to cover everything that happened in the tour, really, and exactly how I felt and how it was. So, yeah, just tried to put that down, really. And I don't regret it, but the only thing now is I can just tell that so many questions are just going to be about Froome now all the way till the tour. So it's kind of, yeah, made my own bed for that. But it's actually, yeah, I enjoyed doing it. And for, it's like anything, you know, you do something good and then something else is around the corner and you kind of forget about it almost, and you don't actually get time to sit down and really reflect on it. And doing that book really helped with that as well. And I wrote it with Tom Fordyce, who, he's a chief sports writer for BBC, and he was there for the whole tour as well, out there with me. So it was quite easy to sort of to do and enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Another element of the book that I found was really honest and revealing, and it kind of spoke to me personally as well, was these sort of themes of masculinity and this inclination to be really stoic and not really open up, even like with your wife in the midst of the Tour de France, in the midst of this really important moment in your life. What are the roots of this attitude? Is this about how you were raised, or is this something that's bred out of the sport of cycling?
I think it's just how I am, really. Yeah, like I say in the book, you know, it was all about just trying to play it down all the time in my head. And even though, you know, you kind of tell yourself, oh, it's just a bike race or whatever, and it's not, is it? It's the biggest bike race in the world, and it can change your life. And but yeah, you just downplay it all the time, and I never tried to get emotional. I was always trying to stay logical, and I'd always done that in the past, but then working a bit with Steve Peters, the sports psychologist, just reinforced everything that I was doing anyway, really.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that sort of attitude and approach, one of the really interesting dynamics in this book is this tension between yourself and Team Sky's management during the Tour de France, and how you find ways to sort of rationalize their decision to continue prioritizing Chris throughout the majority of the tour. You know, there's the team time trial, there's the Col de Portet, all these vignettes that made headlines, of course.
Yeah.
So talk to me about how this process plays out in real time. How do you get over these feelings of maybe being a little jilted or feeling a little, just a little disappointed? Are you able to get over it quickly? And how do you just compose yourself in the midst of the most important bike race of your life?
Yeah, I think to start with, you're obviously a bit like, geez, what's going on, guys? Like, and you get a bit sort of maybe frustrated or whatever. But within sort of half an hour or so, you just think about it, like try and rationalize it and come from their perspective. And then think at the end of the day, well, it's not going to affect how I go and how I race anyway. So just crack on with it and accept it and move on and don't dwell on it. And especially the team time trial, that was stage three. And you know, if I just let that bug me the whole time, then I would have got, well, I don't think I would have won the race, you know, because they would have just dragged you down the whole time, and just your mood and everything would have just been so, you know, up and down, and your performance would kind of follow that.
Does it keep you up at night at all? Is it hard to fall asleep when you think about things like that?
No, not really. It was kind of, you know, once I'd sort of, after that initial half hour and just sort of rationalized it a bit more, how they would be thinking and what they were thinking, and it's just that was it then, put it to bed and move on and just worry about the actual race and not the whole sort of politics of it.
Do those moments, do they impact your overall trust that you have in Team Sky's management?
Not really, no, because like I say in the book, you know, Froome had won 6 Grand Tours, 4 Tour de France's before that, so it was kind of, you can see why they, you know, if they were, you were going to bet on someone, you'd put it on him and rather than myself, who I hadn't even got a top 10 to that point. So, but at the same time, I kind of knew that I had the legs to do it, and they did as well. But I think they were just sort of making sure we were both in the best position to sort of be there. And yeah, that's how I saw it, and that was it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask sort of specifically about team management is that, you know, here we are in January and they've got 6 months, less than 6 months probably, to find a new sponsor for 2020. And it was pretty well reported that, you know, you had a deal from CCC on the table, you signed a deal with Team Sky, and a lot of us thought that meant that Team Sky's future was secure. So kind of what's your current state of overall trust with Team Sky? I mean, do you trust that they're telling you, yes, we'll be able to find something for 2020?
Yeah, I think so. I believe in Dave and Fran and, you know, the team that are out there looking for a new sponsor. And, you know, the way I see it is we're in the best shape to find one. You know, we're the best bike racing team in the world, if not one of the best sporting teams, really, you know, with the success we've had in such a short space of time. And, yeah, like I say, yeah, it's the best position to find something. And, you know, they're going out there and working the hardest to find that. And, yeah, got all faith that they can. And obviously, if they don't, then, you know, come, yeah, July, August, then you're going to have to look elsewhere. But, yeah, you know, I think the structure and everything there, that the team is proven and everything's in place. So it's not like it's starting from scratch and finding a sponsor, having to build everything. So you'd think that would be appealing to a lot of companies and or individuals or whatever, really. So yeah, we'll see. Time will tell with that, I guess.
Are you second guessing your decision to extend with Sky at all?
No, not at all, really, because the reasons I did it were, you know, the fact that I've got 3 more good years trying to win Grand Tours, really, and I felt that this team was the best one for me, and, you know, I've still got next year. And then, yeah, I'm confident they'll find something anyway and keep it going. And if not, then you'll have to go elsewhere and sort of take that risk that I didn't really want to take before, which was the reason I stayed. But that's the way it goes, isn't it? It's like changes happen sometimes, they're out of your control, and you just got to accept it and move on and just stay positive and keep, you know, doing what you do.
Yeah. All right, we'll shift gears away from, it's a little awkward, I realize, but we'll shift gears. So, well, maybe it's up to you. You can close your eyes if you want, but I want you to visualize all the memories from this past year's tour. Tell me about the one that's the clearest, sort of the most poignant, the one that's really the memory that's going to stay with you the rest of your life.
I think finishing the time trial, knowing, like, finally just accepting and realizing that I'd won the tour. Because up until that point, like I say, I was never thinking about the end. It was always about the next stage or the next climb and the process and eating this at this time and, you know, trying to recover the best and sleeping and all that type of stuff. And then suddenly there was nothing else to focus on. It was done and I'd won. And that elation was just like unreal. And then my wife was there, and I didn't know she was going to be there, and like the team had flown her out especially for the end of the TT, and because she kind of thinks she's a bit of a bad luck omen, because a few times she's come out to a big race and I've crashed out. So yeah, for sure that TT was the unreal, and something that will always stay with me.